Lesson number 5 in the series of Old Testament survey over the book of Exodus. This is another long book, so at least read chapter 1, verse 1 through chapter 2, verse 15. Chapters 3, 12, 14, verses 8 through 31, 16, verses 1 through 16, 17, verses 1 through 7, 20, verses 1 through 20, and chapter 25, verses 1 through 9. In our last lesson, we talked about Genesis, the book of beginnings. One of these beginnings was the Jewish race. When Abraham left Haran on the northern side of the Euphrates and moved to Canaan, the people referred to him as that man from the other side of the river. The word was Eber. From that developed the name Hebrews, people from the other side of the river. This was their first name. As time passed, they also became known as the children of Israel, or Israelites. Although descended from Jacob, the deceiver, they were always associated with Jacob's new name, Israel, prince with God. Over the years, the family clan of Abraham, Isaac, and Jacob lived in the land of Canaan. Then, because of a famine, the clan of 66 people moved to Egypt to join Joseph and his family. Over the next 430 years, the combined group of 70 grows into a nation. During all this time, they live in the land of Egypt. But this is not the land God promised to Abraham, Isaac, and Jacob. The story and theme of Exodus is the Jews' exit from Egypt as they head back to Canaan, which was the promised land. God is going to take them out. The main people are Moses, Aaron, Miriam, Pharaoh, and God. Moses is the author. He writes it around 14 or 1300 BC. To give you a sense of time, chapter 1 covers 350 years. Chapter 2 covers 80 years. And chapters 3 through 40 cover 2 years. The Jews' departure, or exodus, is described in 3 stages. Chapters 1 through 12, Israel in Egypt. Chapters 13 through 19, Israel en route. And chapters 20 through 40, Israel at Mount Sinai. While at Mount Sinai, God's people receive the law and the Old Testament tabernacle. Instead of a summary sentence, Exodus begins with a summary chapter. Chapter 1 reviews 350 years of history. Verses 1 through 6 cover the last 73 years of Joseph's life in the 1800s BC. It is repeating the last part of Genesis. Verse 7 uses one sentence to cover the next 200 years. It is during this time the family clan develops into the Jewish nation. Verse 8 ends these 273 years by saying, "A new king of Egypt has come to power." Because 200 years have gone by since Joseph's death, he has never heard of Joseph. This brings us to the 1600s BC. It is from the book of Ezekiel, near the end of the Old Testament, that we find out what happened next. According to Ezekiel chapter 20, verses 6 through 8, God tells his people he's ready to take them out of Egypt. But first, they have to stop worshiping the Egyptian gods. However, the Jews have become comfortable in Egypt and do not want to leave. They've fallen in love with Egyptian life and the Egyptian gods. Because they continue to rebel against God, he has to send consequences. He uses this new king to do it. Over the next 75 years, the king forces God's people into slave labor to build some of his cities. As their suffering gets worse, the Jews become disillusioned with life in Egypt. If only they could leave. In their desperation, they finally turn to God, pleading for his help. When God's people turn from God, He allows suffering and hardships to bring His people back to Him, and sometimes He even uses government. 2 years before Moses is born, the suffering gets worse. The king commands all Jewish baby boys to be killed by throwing them into the Nile River. Satan is behind this command. Back in the Garden of Eden, God told Satan a man would be born who would destroy his power. Now at the time of Moses, Satan knows the man will come through the Jewish race. So Satan uses the king of Egypt to destroy them. If all Jewish boys are killed and only the girls survive, eventually the girls will have to marry Egyptians. Within one or two generations, the Jews would be completely absorbed. There would be no longer a Jewish race, and that man Jesus could not be born. But God has other plans. Moses is born, and his parents hide him in their home for 3 months. Then they move him to a waterproof basket made of reeds and place it near the bank of the Nile River. His sister Miriam is also there to watch him. She's about 7 or 8 years old. One day, Pharaoh's daughter comes to the river, sees the baby, and wants to adopt him. Miriam goes to Pharaoh's daughter and asks, "Would you like me to find a Jewish woman to nurse the baby for you?" Since the Jews were slaves, no Egyptian woman would want this role. Pharaoh's daughter agrees, and Miriam goes to get their mother. Notice how God works far beyond their expectations. According to chapter 2, verse 9, not only can Moses' parents raise him without any fear, but they will also be paid for doing it. During the next few years, Moses' parents teach him all they can about God. When he's about 5 years old, Moses is taken to the palace because he is considered the son of Pharaoh's daughter. As a child, and then a teenager, he has the best education there is. Then he's given a university doctorate, studying subjects like science, astronomy, medicine, and mathematics. He will have leadership and military training. In addition, he's taught the Egyptian religion with their many gods and practices. In Egypt at this time, the age of 40 is the age of adulthood and maturity. In the palace, this is the age when a person is named potential heir to the throne. Since Moses has been adopted by Pharaoh's daughter, he is in line for this position. So when he turns 40, he has to decide, will he identify himself with the Egyptians as heir to the throne, or will he identify himself with the Jewish people in slavery? Let's turn to the book of Hebrews in the New Testament to read about his decision. Hebrews chapter 11, verse 24. Chapter 11, verse 24. By faith, Moses, when he had grown up, meaning he reached the age of 40, refused to be known as the son of Pharaoh's daughter. He chose to be mistreated along with the people of God rather than to enjoy the pleasures of sin for a short time, meaning worshiping the idols of Egypt. He regarded disgrace for the sake of Christ as of greater value than the treasures of Egypt because he was looking ahead to his reward. The author of Hebrews says Moses makes his decision on the basis of faith. Although he's lived in the palace around Egyptian idols for 35 years, his faith has remained strong from the training he received from his parents. As a result of his first 5 years, Moses is able to make a choice to follow God when he is 40. Never minimize the ability of a small child to understand about God. Soon after Moses makes his decision, he sees an Egyptian beating a Jew. He kills the Egyptian and buries him in the sand, thinking no one has seen him. The next day, when two Jews are fighting, he asks them, "Why are you fighting?" One of them replies, "Who made you a leader over us? Are you going to kill me like you killed that Egyptian?" Moses makes the same mistake as Abraham and Jacob. He knows God's plan, but does not wait for God to act. He tries to get the answer on his own, doing it his way instead of God's way. The consequences last 40 years. Since Moses is no longer a part of the royal family, killing an Egyptian makes him a wanted man. He leaves Egypt and goes to the land of Midian. It is on the eastern side of the Sinai Peninsula and not under Egyptian authority. The Midianite people descended from a son of Abraham, so they are distant relatives. Moses finds housing and work with a man named Jethro. He is also called Reuel, although we're not sure why. Moses works as a shepherd, marries one of Jethro's daughters, and eventually has two children. Moses' education in Egypt prepared him in many ways, but God now gives him further training. During his 40 years as shepherd in the Sinai Peninsula, he gets to know the geography and every detail. He also learns patience and the ability to wait for God's timing. One day Moses takes the sheep south towards the tip of the Sinai Peninsula. He sees flames coming out of a bush, but it is not burning up. As he goes toward it, he hears God's voice. God identifies himself as the God of Abraham, Isaac, and Jacob. Over the next year, Moses will experience God as Abraham, Isaac, and Jacob did in the past. He will experience God as the one who can do the impossible, the one who provides, and the one who can change us. When Moses identified himself with God's people, he knew God wanted him to be their leader. When he killed the Egyptian, he assumed the people knew he was their leader because he had the education and preparation. Now he understands God will work through his abilities, but the people are God's people, and God is the one who will do it. Moses has experienced God as the God of Jacob. God has changed him from arrogant to humble, from impatient to patient. For 300 years, the Jews have worshipped and followed the hundreds of Egyptian gods. When they talk about a god in general, they use the word El, meaning God. When they talk about a specific god, they use a descriptive or defining name, such as the god of fire, the sun god, the moon god. If Moses goes to Egypt and says, "El sent me," the Jews will ask, "God who? Which of the many gods sent you?" This explains Moses' question, "When the people ask me, who sent me, what should I say?" God replies in chapter 3, verse 14, "Tell them, I am sent you." The purpose of this name is to show the Jews their God is different from the Egyptian gods. He is not an animal, a thing, or a force. He is a person. I am. In addition, he does not depend on anything or anyone else for his existence. He is apart from and above everything else. In Hebrew, the name I am can also be translated I will be. God is saying to Moses, "In the future, there will be a lot of problems and needs, but I will be to you and to the people all you will ever need me to be." This name for God applies not just to Moses, but also to us. No matter what we go through or what problem we have, God will always be adequate for our need. His grace will always be sufficient. What a wonderful promise. When God is speaking about himself, he uses the name I am. But when he wants people to use this name for him, it has to be changed from I am to he is. Originally, Hebrew writing only had consonants. The Hebrew word for he is had four letters, YHWH. This became a name for God, YHWH. When the Bible was being put into English, translators came to this Hebrew name meaning he is. They knew they could not translate it literally. He is said this, he is did that. So they transliterated it. They used the original Hebrew letters for the English name. Since they were German, they wrote the letters based on German alphabet. The Y sound in German is written as J, so they wrote J. The H stayed the same. The W in German is pronounced like a V, so they wrote V. The final H stayed the same. YHWH became JHVH. Because all English words need vowels, they added an E, O, and A. The Hebrew name YHWH became the English name Jehovah. This was done in the 1600s AD. In the 1800s, Bible scholars stopped using the name Jehovah and changed it to the name Lord. But this was already the translation for another name of God, the Hebrew name Adonai. God used these, as well as many other names, as a revelation of his nature, to reveal what he's like. Adonai points to God's authority and power. The YHWH name points to God's relationship and salvation for his people. To show English readers which Hebrew name is in the original, scholars wrote the YHWH name as Lord in all capital letters. When the Hebrew name was Adonai, they wrote Lord as capital L, small letters O-R-D. But unless some teacher explained this, English readers would never know why the name Lord was written in two different ways. So in the 1900s, translators went back to the YHWH name, putting in the vowels A and E. They gave us the name Yahweh. However, most Bibles have never accepted that name and still use the two forms of Lord. But Yahweh is the name that God used to identify himself to Moses and the Jewish people in Egypt. By using this name, he was telling them he wanted to once again establish a relationship with them. He wanted to save them out of their slavery. He would be their God, and they would be his people. Jesus also used this name for himself when he said, "Before Abraham was born, I am." It is through Jesus we can have a relationship with the Father, and we can be free from the slavery of sin. After Exodus chapter 3, the name that is most often used for God is Yahweh, or capital L-O-R-D. Pharaoh is told Yahweh is the name of the Jewish God. The Jews themselves start hearing the phrase Yahweh, your God, or more literally, Yahweh, your El. All nations and people had their El, their God. For the Jews, Yahweh is their El, a God of relationship and salvation. God now sends Moses back to Egypt. He's 80 years old. The king who wanted to kill him has died. Through Moses, God brings 10 plagues or disasters on Egypt. Each one is an attack on one of the gods of Egypt. In Exodus chapter 12, verse 12, God says, "On that same night, I will pass through Egypt and strike down every firstborn, both men and animals, and I will bring judgment on all the gods of Egypt." This is going to be a battle of the gods. In the end, both the Egyptians and the Jews have to decide who really is God. The first nine plagues are based on natural disasters common to that area. However, God shows them to be supernatural by making them worse than usual, briefer than usual. They will start and stop at the word of Moses, and some will only affect the Egyptians, but not the Israelites. They take place from June to the following April. There will be 10 plagues in 11 months. In June, the Nile River always floods. It turns red from the sediment upriver. In the first plague, the Nile River turns red like blood. It could have been the natural sediment, red tide, or supernaturally changed to blood. It will last for 7 days instead of the usual 20 days of flooding. What is important is that it is an attack on the Nile River god Hapi, H-A-P-I. The Egyptians worshipped the river because it gave life to their land, their animals, and to them. But now the Nile is giving death. There is also another significance. So many Jewish baby boys had been killed by throwing them in the river. It is as though their blood was crying out for justice. God has seen it. In September, frogs were always a problem. The Egyptians worshipped the frog as the goddess of creation and earth. Any animal they worship should not be killed. Can you imagine the frogs in their houses, cookware, and beds? Yet they cannot kill them because they're gods. That which they worship has now become a torment to them. During October, Egypt had problems with lice. Moses uses the dust of the earth to produce the third plague. Scholars are not sure if the word means gnats or lice. For the Egyptians, the earth was the father of all the gods. But now the earth has caused this plague, and there is nothing they can do to control it. Personally, I think the plague is lice because of the significance. The Egyptian religion had a rule that no one could enter any of their temples if they had lice on them. It was considered a sacrilege. So, with a plague of lice, neither people nor priest could enter the temples. Their whole system of worship would have been shut down. In November, there's a problem with flies. This becomes plague number four. To control them, the Egyptians had a god, Baalzebub, lord of the flies. But when flies are sent by Yahweh God, the Egyptian god can do nothing. From pictures of Egypt, we know the people worshipped livestock animals, the cow, bull, calf, and ram. So in December, when God sends a plague that kills animals considered to be gods, it shows these so-called gods cannot even protect or save themselves, much less the people. It is only the livestock animals in the field that are killed. Among the gods that Pharaoh worships, there is also one that requires a human sacrifice, which was burned in a large furnace. Evidently, Pharaoh has just offered a sacrifice to seek relief from the plagues. Moses and Aaron come, take ashes or soot from this furnace, and produce a new plague, boils and ulcers. This probably happens in January. In February, the seventh plague is hail and lightning, which was thought of as water and fire. The Egyptian gods of water and fire are unable to give protection from the water and fire sent by Yahweh God. This happens when the flax is in bloom. Back in December, during the fifth plague, the livestock in the field had been killed. However, there'd also been livestock in shelters, both as they gave birth and where the newborns stayed. Now in February, this livestock has been moved to the fields. The Egyptians are warned that the plague of hail will kill them unless they are returned to the shelters. In March, the Egyptians always had problems with locusts, so they had a god to protect them from severe plagues. But when Yahweh God sends a locust plague, the Egyptian god is powerless to help them. Also in March are the sandstorms. Severe storms can block out the sun, sky, or even the light of day. God uses a sandstorm to produce darkness. However, it is supernatural because it is only among the Egyptians. Where the Jews live, there is no darkness. This ninth plague of darkness is an attack on their sun god Ra and the sky god Horus. The sky god is shown to be completely powerless. Yet some people still worship him today. His name has changed a little. He's known as the horoscope. The word horoscope comes from the sky god Horus. When people use the horoscope to make life decisions, they are worshiping the Egyptian sky god even if they do not realize it. We may not think of it this way, but whatever controls our life is our God. In April is the 10th and final plague. It is the death of the firstborn son and firstborn animals in each home. For the Egyptians, this will be the most devastating of all the plagues because it kills the immediate heir to the throne. This is an attack on all the gods of Egypt because not one of them can protect the Egyptian people. Even the Jews have to go through this plague, but not one of their sons has to die. God tells them how they can escape this judgment. Each family must kill a lamb, put some of its blood on the doorpost of their house, roast the lamb, eat it, have everything packed, and be ready to leave immediately. At midnight, God will kill the oldest son and the firstborn of the animals in every house. But if he sees the blood on the doorpost, he will pass over that house. The blood proved a lamb died in place of the oldest son. The blood had to be applied to his house. It had to be personal. Some of the Jews would have asked, why? Why put blood on the doorpost? We may never get it off. Others would have asked, how? How can the blood outside have anything to do with my son inside? Since these were such strange commands, it was reasonable for people to ask questions. That was okay. The important part was their obedience. Jews who had faith did what God said. Faith in God is coming to God in God's way, in the way He says. These commands for Passover night were so exact because God was creating another picture of Jesus. The Lamb died to save the Son from physical death. Jesus would be God's Lamb. He died to save people from spiritual death, from separation from God. To see the picture from another angle, when the Jews acted in faith, their oldest son had physical life. When we act in faith to accept Jesus' payment, we will have spiritual life, enjoyment of God now and throughout all eternity. Faith in God is coming to God in God's way. For the Jews, the lamb dying in place of the oldest son was so important that they were commanded to remember it every year. They call it the Passover, when God passed over their house and their oldest son did not die. Where the Egyptians lived, it was very different. At midnight, the king finds his oldest son has died. He discovers the oldest son in every Egyptian home has died. With this, Pharaoh sends word to Moses, take all your people and animals and leave Egypt. Because of God's earlier commands, the Jews are packed and ready to leave. They head southeast towards what the Bible calls the Red Sea. The actual name is Reed Sea. It was located where the Suez Canal is today. Moses remembers to take Joseph's bones with them so he can eventually be buried in the Promised Land. The people are thrilled with their new freedom as they head towards the Reed Sea. But back in Egypt, Pharaoh decides he cannot afford to lose his free labor. Several days later, he and the army go after them. When the Jews see the Egyptians and understand their situation, they are paralyzed with fear. The Egyptian army is in the back of them, the Reed Sea in front, mountains are to the south, and wilderness to the north. They are trapped. The situation is impossible. God now becomes the God of Abraham for them, the one who can do the impossible. God tells Moses to stretch out his rod over the Reed Sea. The water is parted and the people cross over on a dry bed. God puts a fog bank in front of the Egyptians so they cannot make any progress or even see what is happening. Once all the Jews have crossed over to the other side, he lifts the fog and the Egyptians come to the edge of the sea. If the Jews could get across, they can too. Once the entire army is in the dry bed, God has Moses stretch out his hand from the other side and the waters return. Pharaoh and his army are drowned. God can do the impossible. Since he is the creator, he can control his creation. The Jews have seen that Yahweh, their God, has saved them from the Egyptian army. They rejoice with praise and thanksgiving. They compose a special song. But their joy does not last. As they go down the western side of the Sinai Peninsula, they begin to complain. There is plenty of pasture for the animals, but what about them? What will they do for food and water? It is God who provides. He gives them bread in the form of manna. He gives meat by means of quail. He leads Moses to a rock, which when he strikes it, produces water. In these events, God shows himself to be the God of Isaac, the one who provides. Eventually, they come to Mount Sinai. Turn to the back of a Bible or Bible atlas and find a map of the Exodus. The Sinai Peninsula is near the bottom of the map. At the southern tip, you will see Mount Sinai. It is part of a long mountain range running north and south. The whole range is called Horeb or Mount Horeb. One of the peaks is Mount Sinai. The book of Exodus uses the names Horeb and Sinai interchangeably. The Jews stay in the Mount Sinai area for about 1 year. During this time, they receive national laws. God will also give them a new form of worship with the building of the Old Testament tabernacle. The last part of Exodus tells about the construction of the tabernacle. The book of Leviticus describes the operation of the tabernacle. We will study them together in our next lesson. In closing, I want to answer two questions that people often ask. First, Exodus chapter 4, verse 11. In this verse, God asks Moses, "Who gave man his mouth? Who makes him deaf or dumb? Who gives him sight or makes him blind? Is it not I, the Lord?" We assume God is talking about the physical. But in reality, he's talking about the spiritual. Moses has just told God he does not have the ability to give God's message. He claims he's not good at speaking, but this is not true. The New Testament tells us he was powerful in speech. God does not argue by saying that's not true. Instead, he uses it as a teaching opportunity. To paraphrase it, God says, "Moses, you just said you cannot obey because you do not have the ability. But who gave man his mouth to give my message? Who makes him deaf or dumb so he cannot hear or speak my message? Who gives him spiritual insight? Or who makes him blind to spiritual truth? Is it not I, the Lord? If Moses obeys, he will have God-given ability. If he refuses to obey, God will discipline him by taking away the spiritual abilities he has. Jesus said of the Jews in the past and in his day, because they refuse to obey, although seeing, they do not see, though hearing, they do not hear or understand. When there is spiritual disobedience, God brings spiritual blindness, deafness, and the inability to speak for him. This is why the New Testament says, he who has an ear, let him hear what the Spirit says to the churches. The second question is about Pharaoh. God told Moses ahead of time that he would harden Pharaoh's heart so the king will not let the people go. But that sounds unfair. If God made Pharaoh refuse, how can God punish him? In the Jewish style of writing, there's always a summary statement at the beginning with the details afterwards. Two times in Exodus, God says he will harden Pharaoh's heart. Both times, it is a summary statement. God is telling Moses the final results before anything has even started. When we look at the details of the story, we discover it is Pharaoh who first hardens his heart. After each of the first six plagues, we are told Pharaoh hardened his heart. During the seventh plague, Pharaoh admits, I have sinned. Yahweh is right. I am wrong. Pharaoh has full understanding. But as soon as the plague stops, he says no to God, and again he hardens his heart. Because the king has full understanding, there's nothing more God can do for him or give to him. It is only at this point that God hardens his heart. It is the consequence of Pharaoh's choices. In God's plan to get his people out of Egypt, God used his sovereignty. He decided to work through two people, Pharaoh and Moses. Each had free will to say yes or no to God. Moses said yes, and his life was enriched. He was used in the lives of others. If Pharaoh had said yes, he would have come down in history as one of the greatest leaders of all time. We would have known his exact name. In letting the Jewish people go, God would have blessed him. But instead, Pharaoh said no, and his life was impoverished. His choice messed up his life and the lives of everyone around him. But his choices did not mess up God's plan. Even without his cooperation, God still used Pharaoh to get his people out of Egypt. Today, God continues to use people in his plan. He looks down from heaven saying, I want to use you for this. I want to use you for that. Regardless of our choices, his plan will be accomplished. But he always gives us freedom to choose. If we say no, we will mess up our life and the lives of those around us. If we say yes, our life will be enriched. We will have an impact on the lives of others. God is active in everyone's life, whether they know it or not. But the way in which he is active is determined by our choices. We can either be a Moses or a Pharaoh. We can either say yes to God, or we can say no. Let's close in prayer. Father, thank you for the gift of free will. Help us to see how wonderful it is, and then give us discernment to use it wisely. Show us the importance of our choices, and give us the strength to say yes to you. Thank you that it is through our choices we can become the men and women you created us to be. Thank you, this is possible because of Jesus. Amen.